Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high-quality continuing professional development for GOC-registered optometrists. You can gain one CPD point by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on our website, docket.info. This is the second episode of Sound Optometry all about brain tumours. As a reminder, brain tumours are the abnormal growth or a mass of cells in or around the brain which can come in various shapes and sizes. They can cause a range of problems, from difficulties with memory and language to mobility issues, and for many people they are life-threatening. In our last episode we heard about brain tumours from a patient's perspective. If you haven't heard our interview with Colin McCann, scroll back to episode 51 of Sound Optometry on your podcast app. There are a wealth of lessons we can learn from his story. This time, I'll be in conversation with Lorcan Butler, an optometrist with the Brain Tumour Charity. He'll explain what signs to look out for in our patients and why optometrists actually play a crucial role in catching brain tumours early. Well, thank you very much for joining me, Lorcan.
You're welcome.
So just to kick off, can you give us an outline of why it's so important for optometrists to understand brain tumours?
Sure. There is a big link between eyes and brain tumours. Approximately a third of people with a brain tumour will experience visual problems. And that can be blurry vision, double vision, damage to the peripheral vision, and they may not be aware of it. So it could be a primary point of contact. They could be coming to us as their first healthcare practitioner. They could be discharged from the hospital after treatment for a brain tumour, or they may be returning to us to receive a driving licence statement to go back to the DVLA. So we need to be aware of the impact that brain tumours can have on somebody's vision.
They are relatively rare though, aren't they?
Surprisingly, they are increasing because we're in an ageing population. So you'll tend to find people in the 60s, 70s, 80s are a bit more prone to developing brain tumours. So as we're living longer, the brain tumour incidence is increasing, but slowly. As an optometrist, the likelihood of seeing a brain tumour in practice is extremely slim.
And do you think GPs are more likely to come into contact with patients with brain tumours earlier than optometrists would?
Yes, they do. Unfortunately, an awful lot of people don't have visual symptoms, only 30%, so 70% don't have visual symptoms, and they'd be presenting to a first contact practitioner, either a pharmacist or a GP. And unfortunately, that journey doesn't tend to be very successful for them because brain tumours tend to have a range of non-specific symptoms, which are very, very difficult for a GP to isolate as a brain tumour. And the typical journey that our brain tumour sufferers tend to go on is maybe 3, 4, 5 visits to a GP and without getting resolution of their symptoms. And then they lose confidence in the GP and the healthcare support network, and then they just tend to suffer in silence. And approximately 60% of brain tumour diagnoses come from accident and emergency when they present. And unfortunately, the prognosis doesn't tend to be as good or as favourable at that stage.
Because it's more advanced.
Yeah.
So, Lorcan, what are the different types of brain tumour?
There's lots of different types. The World Health Organization tend to classify them into primary brain tumours, secondary brain tumours, which metastasize from other areas. Meningiomas tend to be a very common one that optometrists get because it does tend to affect the cranial nerves, and that can lead then to an onset of a paresis or a palsy in children or adults. So astrocytoma, a glioform mastoma, tends to be another one.
So that brings me on to the next question. How do brain tumours typically affect people?
Lots of different ways. They can be visual, as I said, 30%, 70% are non-visual. A lot of people don't know they have them. It can be an incidental finding. So they go for an MRI scan or a CAT scan for something else and it's detected. Sometimes there's personality changes that a loved one, a carer, a family member will recognise. Sometimes they can change in their gait, their balance, sometimes a neurological defect, and a loss of control and maybe a limb. And epilepsy tends to be a very strong association with brain tumours, either as a presenting symptom or as a secondary symptom too as well.
So you mentioned that around 30% of people with brain tumours actually have visual signs. How do these signs manifest?
Depending on the location, Michelle, that can have an impact on either the visual field, it can have an impact on the optic nerve, it can be causing compression, it can have an impact on the cranial nerve. The sixth cranial nerve tends to be the most common one due to the tumour growth. You'll tend to find if it's maybe wrapped around the optic nerve or interfering with the chiasm, etc. However, not every brain tumour will have those visual symptoms, and that's why we need to be able to listen to non-visual symptoms presented in history.
Listeners will hopefully have heard the last episode of Sound Optometry, which I interviewed Conor McCann. He found out about his condition when he was admitted to hospital following an accident on the way home from work. Conor told me that he had no signs prior to that. Did you have any inkling that there was anything wrong, any signs or symptoms?
No, not at all, Michelle, which is very unlike most brain tumours. Most of them present sort of with seizures or with numbness or tingling. Mine didn't have any of that, so I consider myself very lucky to got a jump on that and to find it earlier than it would have normally presented.
Did you have any signs, ophthalmic signs at all, that you had a brain tumour? So typically in practice we look for things like optic nerve issues like papilledema.
No clinical signs whatsoever. So no drop in VA, no optic neuritis, no swollen optic nerve heads, nothing.
Lorcan, I know you know Conor as well. What should we take away from Conor's story?
Conor is a real good example of somebody who has seen both sides of it, both as an optometrist and also as a brain tumour sufferer. His was an incidental finding. He wasn't having any visual symptoms. So as optometrists, we need to be able to be aware that not everybody presenting to your practice will be the typical person who has vision problems, that there might be underlying conditions. And that's where we need to have a very thorough history and symptoms to pick up underlying conditions that maybe aren't necessarily eye-related. Somebody maybe says a change, a gain in weight, which can be linked with idiopathic intracranial hypertension. Somebody's partner saying that they're sleeping an awful lot more. We're very, very good at picking up vocal cues from adults, but sometimes in the pediatric cohort, the symptoms don't tend to be similar as the adults. So we need to be aware of this factor too.
When I did speak to Conor, he mentioned that optometrists generally are aware of brain tumours because we're aware of papilledema. So what is the link between papilledema and brain tumours?
Approximately 30 to 60% of people with brain tumours will have a papilledema. The figures do tend to vary depending on which clinical studies you have, but not all brain tumours can be detected in eye examination. That's probably the number one question I get asked, Michelle, is will you see a brain tumour if you do an eye examination? And the answer is no. Depending where the brain tumour is located, it may be having an impact or it may not be having an impact on the visual pathway. So as optometrists, sometimes we can do a very thorough eye examination and not see anything, and then people just automatically assume, well, it was missed. So not every brain tumour does have an impact on the eye or the visual pathway.
But when it does, and papilledema is present, what are the clinical signs and symptoms to look out for?
There's non-visual clues such as weight gain, sleep, change in personality, headaches, and then we have the visual clues too as well, which would lead to optic nerve dysfunction. So you'd have a relative afferent pupillary defect, colour vision defects, visual field defects, and sometimes visual acuity. But not necessarily everybody will fit that bill, so that represents 90% of people. There is 10% of the minority that will have none of those symptoms, and we will just pick it up maybe on an OCT or a visual field defect. So it could just be a normal eye examination, they've got no symptoms, and we may be the first person who can detect it.
And of course, just because you think you have found papilledema, it doesn't mean that the patient has got a brain tumour, because there can be other reasons.
Yeah, we have lots of kind of different ones. So you'll tend to find it's usually a trauma, a knock, a bang. It can be a bleed. It can be an internal hemorrhage. And it can also be meningitis, encephalitis, hydrocephalus. And then we have a brain tumour too as well. And then we have other conditions. The one that we come across a lot is IIH, which is idiopathic intracranial hypertension.
So it is important not to jump to the worst case scenario.
Correct. Yeah. And unfortunately, that's what we tend to do because it tends to be, you know, quite prominent in the optometric community. We automatically think papilledema equals a brain tumour, but it doesn't necessarily mean that way. And that's why you have to be very careful medical legally also as well. When people ask us what you think could be, is we don't know. So we have to refer for further investigation.
So, Lorcan, as optometrists, we're very aware of papilledema, but it can be quite difficult to determine what is truly papilledema and what is a pseudo-papilledema. So how would you recommend that practitioners go about trying to differentiate between the two?
Yeah, usually pseudopapilledema tends to kind of be three main ones we talk about, which is optic nerve head drusen, a crowded congenital disc, and a bilateral tilted disc. The optic nerve head drusen is the number one reason we get it wrong. So when we refer patients down for suspect discs or dodgy discs, approximately 75% of them have optic nerve head drusen, especially in children. In a high volume clinic, you're going to see crowded optic discs and bilateral tilted discs an awful lot. So usually pseudopapilledema is not going to have any other symptoms. So if you have optic nerve injuries and if you've bilateral tilted disc, if you've got congenital crowded disc, they don't have the other associated symptoms that a papilledema would have, such as headaches, a change in personality. They do have colour vision changes and they do have visual field defect changes. It's an important one too as well in children. It's one thing we don't tend to do in the UK is do visual field defects. But you'll tend to find with optic nerve injuries, up to 60-75% of children will have visual field defects. So getting that done. Also colour vision.
So how can we differentiate between papilledema and other conditions such as optic neuritis?
Yeah, well, you'll tend to find optic neuritis tends to be quite an important one, because if you look at the age and gender phenotypes of optic neuritis and papilledema, they tend to be the same. They tend to be young females, usually kind of peak onset is early 30s. However, there does tend to be variations, because usually an optic neuritis is an acute condition, while the majority of papilledemas tend to be more progressive, more chronic. And also papilledema is a bilateral condition, while optic neuritis is a unilateral condition. So you'll tend to find it does have some similarities in age and gender, but the other similarities don't tend to mix in terms of the fundoscopy appearance.
And of course, there are also those patients that have those blurred disc margins. So how would you manage those when the patient's asymptomatic?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And that's the second most common question I get asked in practice. And it tends to be kind of, you know, what do you do with somebody who's got a blurry disc margin nasally? And again, it tends to be down to your experience and your risk profile. If you're able to get the patient to come back and return to recheck your findings, so repeat your OCT, your digital retinal camera, your visual fields. However, you may or may not have that ability. Some practitioners I speak to now say that their practice owners don't want these people come back for repeat tests. Maybe the patient themselves is a little bit nervous and maybe want to be referred. But this is where there's no national guidelines. There's no specific guidelines of what you should do. It tends to be down to practitioner ideology, what they think should be happening.
And I guess on the day you have to make a decision with the information that you have in front of you, don't you? So if you've got a blurred disc margin, you're going back to the history symptoms, looking at, is there anything there? Are there any extra clues? Is there anything that I've missed? You're looking at your fundoscopy findings compared to your visual field test if you've done one. And if you are suspicious that a patient has a brain tumour, what are the other key clinical investigations that we should carry out?
Well, we're very, very lucky in practice now to have a huge range of adjunct testing and ancillary testing. And again, one of the important things I want to be able to stress upon our listeners is to throw everything at them. So do colour vision testing, do visual field testing. The majority of practice would have a digital retinal camera, a visual field, an OCT, and put them all together. And we call it multimodal viewing. We don't just look at an optic nerve and think that has glaucoma. We look at the optic nerve and think, well, that maybe is glaucomatous looking, what's the intraocular pressures, what's the visual feel like, what's the family history, what's the age profile. We do this routinely, but unfortunately when it comes to papilledema and brain tumours, we tend to get a bit jerky and we tend to think, well, that's a dodgy looking disc, I'm going to refer that. And you should be thinking, hang on, you know, are there other symptoms? Was there a colour vision defect? Was there a visual field defect? Did anything appear on OCT? And going back to symptoms.
You mentioned that OCT is a good tool to use when you suspect papilledema. So what is it that we're actually looking for where we carry out OCT of the optic disc?
It's very easy, Michelle. If you can imagine that the optic nerve head is going to be larger, so what that means an OCT is going to be an increase in the overall volume, the overall thickness. And then another one that people aren't really aware of is something called a peripapillary wrinkle or Peyton's lines, because they tend to be definitive findings with a papilledema to differentiate from a pseudopapilledema will be what's referred to as retinal wrinkles or retinal folds. They usually occur superior temporally, inferior temporally. And again, it's just a mechanical side effect of the swollen optic nerve. The surrounding retina's got a stretch to accommodate that. And you'll tend to find if we can use OCT in conjunction with a digital retinal camera, we can see these wrinkles. Unfortunately, OCT is not 100% reliable all the time, but have a look at all the parameters and look at OCT, visual fields, colour vision, OAPD and symptoms to be able to make your final decision.
Yes, it is important to remember not to use it in isolation. And actually, if there is a reason for the patient to have a dodgy looking disc and it's not a brain tumour, sometimes it's been spotted before. So even ask the patient, has anyone ever mentioned to you before that your optic nerve looks different? Have you ever had to see a doctor or hospital to have it have a second opinion. And sometimes they have. And it's not until you're about to refer them that say, oh, well, I've actually been referred for that already. So it's always good to check back with the patient and make sure you've covered that history. Because sometimes it's happened such a long time ago and the patient's forgotten about it or dismissed it because it wasn't a problem.
Yeah. And again, you need to be sensitive in questioning that patient and asking them, you know, with regard to the appearance. And that can be a difficult conversation to have too as well. You don't want to alarm them.
Mm. And it's always a good idea to tell patients that actually, perhaps, you know, in this case, your optometrist does look a little bit unusual, but this is also a common finding in some individuals because that's just the way their eyes are. So it's about explaining it to the patient that just because something's unusual doesn't mean it's abnormal.
We need to be, you know, using words which don't scare. We need to be talking about kind of, you know, a variable, a variation, an irregularity rather than an abnormality or something wrong.
So after we've done all of these examinations and we're thinking about whether or not to refer the patient, are there any additional things that we haven't covered already that might help us make this decision?
There's one or two clues that sometimes the patient doesn't give us that can be very, very helpful in making that decision. Should I refer or should I not refer? And one of these is pulsatile tinnitus. And pulsatile tinnitus is a ringing noise that the patient will hear in their ears, like a whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. Or it's described in clinical papers like a seashell noise in your ear when you go down to the beach. It's shh. And sometimes it's synchronous to the heartbeat. And if you're to ask somebody, you know, do you have a whistling noise, a ringing noise on the ear? And if they were to say yes, that would increase your risk of suspicion. And a friend of mine actually contacted me when they attended one of my training events. And they said a girl had, you know, a ringing noise in her ear, went to the GP, and the GP said, oh, it's nothing to worry about. It's just tinnitus, you know, it'll disappear. And it didn't disappear. And she came into the optometrist and the optometrist found a papilledema and referred her. So the pulsatile tinnitus is a very important one too as well. And then the second one too as well is what we refer to as a TVO, a transient loss of vision. And a transient loss of vision is a momentary fleeting loss of vision, which is due to ischemia, so due to a buildup of pressure within the brain. And this can be monocular, binocular, and it tends to last for 2-3 seconds. And again, the patient won't give you this information, you will have to probe. So by asking very direct, closed questions, do you have a ringing noise in your ear? And does your vision never disappear? And if they were to say yes, that would increase your risk of suspicion and maybe help you decide whether to refer or not.
Is there anything else that's useful to know about from a neurological point of view?
Yeah, the first one is down to kind of, you know, the patient's headaches. There may be a history of headaches and going deeper into headache history. There should be kind of, you know, certain headaches which are red flags. So what neurologists would classify as a first or worst. So a first headache of its type or a worst headache of its type would tend to be red flag symptoms which need to be referred. Headache duration, frequency, onset, increasing, more progressive in nature, not getting any easier. Asking these kind of simple questions can be very, very important. And sometimes when people mention these non-visual symptoms, we tend to zone out a little bit and we just tend to kind of zone in on the eye problems. But having a kind of, you know, an idea of what's actually happening neurologically, and also maybe having a loved one, a care, a family member coming in and giving input to the patient's personality. If there's any changes, maybe a child who's sleeping an awful lot more lethargic, doesn't have the same responses, somebody's personality changing. These can all be neurological signs which we wouldn't normally pick up when a visual eye test. But if we have a thorough history and symptoms, we can pick these things up.
And I guess it's easier to have a loved one in the room or a family member in the room when you're examining a child or a young adult, but quite often adults don't come accompanied to their eye examination. So it is harder to get that feedback from a family member. But I guess if you are suspicious, it is worth highlighting that to the patient, isn't it, to say, well, you know, you think you might be perhaps a little more tired than usual. Has anyone in your family mentioned any unusual behaviour changes or any differences in how you've been? Because sometimes it might be a throwaway comment that a partner's made. Oh, you're sleeping a lot more, you know, things like that.
Yeah, one of the things we see with seizures and epilepsy, when people think about epilepsy, they automatically think about the person on a floor kind of shaking their limbs. And with brain tumours, we tend to have a different type of epilepsy referred to as an absence seizure, where people can just be talking to their loved one, their partner, and then mid-sentence just stop talking for 3, 4, 5 seconds, unbeknown to them. And it's not till their care or their partner says, you know, what were you doing? What happened? And the person says, I don't know what you're talking about. So these are kind of silent seizures that the patient is unaware of happening themselves.
Headaches and other neurological symptoms can sometimes cause distress more acutely, though. Back in April 2021, on episode 9 of Sound Optometry, we heard about the experience of Shannon Broderick, a patient who was diagnosed with papilledema edema due to idiopathic intracranial hypertension.
I woke up on New Year's Day with an incredible headache. I had a moment where I just suddenly couldn't see. My vision was very obscured. As the headache got worse, my vision got worse as well. I had quite a lot of double vision, which was a bit scary because I thought I had four dogs instead of two. And I started to notice these bursts of obscured vision happening more frequently. And I was actually driving to Oxford and I had to pull over on the side of the road because I couldn't see the car in front of me. While I was sitting on the side of the road, I just got this incredible pain in the back of my neck. That's when I was just like, oh my goodness, someone's going to have to come and fetch me because I don't know how I'm going to get home. So the next day I went to the hospital and that's when they did some tests and things like that. And they looked at the back of my eyes and they saw that my nerves were so swollen. I also then had CT scans and so on and blood tests because that was when they grew concerned because of the pressure and the swelling. The doctor said to me that the pressure could be caused by a mass in the brain or by a clot in the brain, or it could be caused by another disease. That was quite scary. And then the next morning, I went and I had another CT scan. And then they said that we'd ruled out the tumor, we'd ruled out the clot. And now it was just to find out if it was the idiopathic intracranial hypertension.
So, Lorcan, the key to Shannon's diagnosis was having headaches in combination with other factors, such as blurred vision and pain in the back of her neck. But we all know that headaches are very common. If we have someone coming in complaining about them, how do we identify what is suspicious compared to what is normal life? I mean, you mentioned first of its type and worst of its type.
Yeah, the first of its type, we refer to these as headache de novos. So especially in somebody over the age of 50 years of age and an increase in age group, it's not normal. So usually the first presentation would be a concern for them. They might present to the GP. The GP then refers to an optometrist and we can ask them for a little bit further. So asking them when it's happening, if it's increase in severity, asking them if it concerns them is a very simple question. And, you know, does it concern you? Not really. I've had them for quite a while. Somebody might say, well, I'm a typical headache habitual sufferer, but these are different. So asking them questions such as those, asking them if there's any other changes apart from the headache. So that can be another clue too as well. But usually kind of, you know, headaches which are worse in the morning time are increasing in severity. The medication they take over the counter, they're increasing that, but it doesn't tend to have the same side effect, and they're concerned about it. And asking them then if they want to do anything further, would you like to speak to somebody further? Have you spoken to your GP? Would you like to speak to your GP? So again, it can be very, very normal to identify headaches, and but is this normal for you? On a scale of 1 to 10, is it a 1 or a 10? And, you know, a simple question like that, you can get an idea.
And I guess that's a really good opening, really, isn't it, to say, is there anything else that's concerning you about your general health? And that's when they might mention, well, my sleep pattern has changed, or, you know, I've put in a bit of weight, or I've been feeling a bit under the weather lately. So it's quite a good way of leading into those.
And with the papilledema, headaches with raised intracranial pressure, they tend to be worse in the morning time. So what tends to happen is they're so severe that people wake up in the morning time from the headache and they can sometimes feel nauseous. And sometimes it's worse when they're lying down. And as they're lying down, the cerebrospinal fluid can't drain and the intracranial pressure increases and the headache intensifies. And once they begin to stand up, move around, go to the bathroom, get dressed, then the cerebrospinal fluid can drain and the intracranial pressure decreases and the headache tends to disappear. So somebody who comes in to you says kind of variable headaches, you know, they don't tend to be too bad, but somebody kind of says they're worse in the morning time, I'm waking up with a headache, or they're increasing in duration, they're increasing in frequency, pain, I'm taking an awful lot more medication, it's never been like this before, the worst headache of my life, etc. These are all red flags.
So if we do think we should refer a patient on, you've mentioned that there are no specific guidelines to follow, but what are the key things to include on a referral letter?
In terms of ophthalmologists, they want a clear, concise, succinct, short referral. The terminology tends to be very specific. Papilledema can only be used once intracranial pressure has been measured. So we should be using the word suspect papilledema. And if you were to put down suspect papilledema at the top of your referral letter, the ophthalmologist or neuro-ophthalmologist will tend to, you know, get that patient in very, very quickly. When they attend their clinic, they might have 30 or 40 referral letters. They'll just do a quick skim read of them. And if you have suspect papilledema on the right top, that letter referral will probably be seen first. So being short, succinct, talking about the optic nerve function test that you recorded, what changes there were, and then any other neurological findings such as headaches and also maybe weight gain, change in personality, they all tend to help the ophthalmologist.
So where a patient has been referred and you're trying to communicate that it is important to refer this patient on, what advice would you give to optometrists about communicating this information to patients?
It's very, very difficult, Michelle. And in the moment and in the time, it can be very stressful for both the patient and also for the practitioner. We work in a very time-pressured environment and it's a difficult conversation to have. So trying to be open, transparent with them as quickly as possible and just saying, we found an irregularity at the back of your eye. It needs to be investigated further. Unfortunately, I don't have the equipment or the knowledge to do that. I'm going to refer you to the hospital to get further assessment. And this is where the conversation needs to be done in a cool, calm, collected manner, not to alarm the patient.
At this point, I'm reminded of the conversation I had on the second ever episode of Sound Optometry with Naz Roof, an ophthalmologist at Moorfields Eye Hospital. Naz gave us plenty of tips for communicating with patients who have suspicious discs.
You're making these diagnoses or telling people that they might have something seriously wrong with them, and it's not something, true papilledema, I don't think something that most optometrists have some experience of. But you have a lot of experience of seeing discs that are just a bit unusual and you want perhaps a second opinion on. So some of it depends on the clinical context that you've got. If you have somebody in front of you that clearly has the red flags or is worrying, then they need to be told very clearly, you need to go to an emergency department to have somebody see you. However, I don't think that's many of the patients that we have. And it's really those other patients where you think, oh, I'm not sure if this disc is normal or not, and you may just want a second opinion. So I think what you say to people in that scenario is, well, I've seen your nerve appearance. It looks a bit unusual. In a small minority of cases, this can be associated with something more significant, and there's lots of causes for this, and they are treatable. I would like to go and get another opinion, somebody who sees this a lot more than I do. So I recommend that you go and see either your GP to get a referral, or I'll write a referral to the eye department.
So I think for me, the key thing that you've said so far is that it's treatable. And therefore, if it's treatable and caught early, the prognosis is probably quite good. So I think that in itself is quite reassuring. And I think I would find it much easier to talk to patients knowing that most of the conditions that cause papilledema are actually treatable.
Well, yeah, most conditions that cause papilledema are treatable. And there will be the very rare scenario where you've got a very severe brain tumour that isn't treatable. But even a lot of the brain tumours that cause you to have raised intracranial pressure, which is, of course, what everybody thinks about, many of those are treatable. And the earlier you catch them, the better.
So if I see a patient who has got a slightly suspicious disc, and as you said, we see lots of very unusual looking discs, but the patient is completely asymptomatic, we probably shouldn't be reaching for the referral pad straight away and referring them to A&E. We should be thinking about the differentials first. So things like dysdrusen, a tilted disc, before going down the worst case scenario and scaring ourselves and our patients.
Well, I think that's a very reasonable way forward. So yes, think about the other conditions that can mimic papilledema in the complete absence of symptoms. And if you're worried, bring them back in a few weeks, because if it is papilledema, it will change and you will see things progress.
I always think that the best thing to say to patients if you're not sure about something is to always tell them to come back to you or phone the practice if anything changes. So that way they know that you're keeping an eye on them.
Yes, and I think it's giving them that kind of safety net that, yes, I'm going to see you again. It's really just to reassure both you and me that this is all there is and I don't think there's anything else going on. And that way, you're very safe.
So just to bring it back to you, Lorcan, where can optometrists go to for more advice about supporting their patients that may have a brain tumour?
the charity, I work for the Brain Tumour Charity, has some fantastic resources which talk about communication with the patient, showing empathy and signposting them to other areas. So we have a lot of people who approach our website because they're suspicious they may have something, or a family member or a friend may have something. And also too, as well, there's other charities. So there's plenty of resources that people can be signposted to.
Lorcan, thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Michelle. Thanks for having me today.
And thank you for listening. If you head to docket.info and search for sound optometry, you can find the additional reading materials and resources for this episode. Remember that if you go on to complete the short exercise on the website, you can gain one CPD point covering clinical practice and communication. And make sure you hit subscribe on your podcast app so that you don't miss the next episode of Sound Optometry, out next month. The producer is Jason Hoskin. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thanks for listening.